This is News in No Time. Ed Gordon on today's roundtable. Racial segregation is no longer permitted in California prisons, and two officers caught on tape pay the price. Joining us today to discuss these topics is Julianne Malvo. She's an economist and author, also president of and CEO of Last Word Productions. She joins us from Washington, D.C. From our New York bureau, Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, and Charles Ogletree, Harvard Law professor, joins us from Harvard University studios there in Cambridge, Mass. Thank you all for joining us. Greatly appreciate it. Let me start with something, and Michael Myers, I'll go directly to you in relation to what we are also seeing, offshoots of this transportation strike, if you will. We are now seeing race interjected, surprise, surprise, in the transit strike debate. The mayor, in a press conference yesterday, used the word thugs when talking about the actions of the union. We are now seeing some city council members and religious leaders in New York City suggesting that this had racial overtones. There are others who are saying, you're going a little bit too far. The term thugs historically has been used when talking about unions in our history here in the United States. How do you think that plays itself out, Michael Myers? Is that being too sensitive, in your opinion?
I think it's ridiculous. I think it's just race baiting. It's I don't have any brief for Mayor Bloomberg. I really don't. I don't like the man. But look, thuggish behavior is thuggish behavior. You have people who have gone out on an unlawful strike against the public interest that involves the safety of New Yorkers, home care workers who cannot get to their senior citizens who are shut up in the outer boroughs. So, yeah, there was no need for this strike. But it's going, I see the end is near, not because of the racial breastbeating of these racial arsonists, but because the judge has said jail is now an option and fines, personal fines, are an option. This is near
Charles Ogletree, let me ask you this from a legal perspective. When you start to hear the term imprisonment in negotiations like this, have you seen historically that it does weaken the resolve of those out on picket lines?
Not at all, Ed, and sometimes it reinforces it. These workers are fighting for a decent wage, a decent pension, a quality of life, and they know in order to fight for what's right for workers, they're going to suffer a risk of fine, suffer possible imprisonment, suffer being subject to derogatory terms like thugs or other terms that Michael used. And I think that, you know, as much as I have relatives and friends who are deeply inconvenienced by this strike, I understand the broader issues at stake. And if there were the right sort of wages and were the right quality of life, this would have been settled long ago. And I think we're going to see both a reasonable settlement and an end to the strike.
Professor,
but not until
they
step
York.
Forward.
These people are very comfortable.
You know, I don't have to live in New York, Michael. That's not
these
the
people
point.
Are very comfortable. But you don't ride out.
Let me stop us there for just a moment. Julianne Malvo, let me ask you this question. I'm coming to you today from my hometown. I'm home for the holidays, WDET here in Detroit, making a fine home for us this week. But let me ask you this as relates to the race baiting question and then pick up on your point. One of the things I heard before I left New York is that there was concern because the Transportation Workers Union president, Roger Toussaint, is a man of color, that you weren't going to see perhaps the same kind of solidarity that historically you have seen from the streets of New York, and that in and of itself, sometimes when a black face is the forward face, it has an adverse effect on how people see it.
You know, I think that that's something to consider, Ed. At the same time, I lived through the last strike. It was 11 days, and it went 11 days, and there was a settlement. People made do. Yes, it was inconvenient. Here's the sticking point on this strike. It's the pension. It's not the wages. The wage increases that the union was asking for was modest, and what MTA is offering is modest. I think 3.5% and 4%, a total of about 10.5%. That is very modest. But the fact is that all those wage increases will be wiped out if the pension contribution has to go up. And that's the thing we have to look at. Unions now, as you know, coming from Detroit, are more disproportionately black and brown than they've ever been. But African-American men and women especially gain more percentage-wise by being in a union than by being unorganized. Whites gain as well, and so the solidarity issue will be there. If anybody needs to go to jail, Michael Myers, it's those MTA officers who have the temerity to take an issue that did not belong on the bargaining table and put it there. That's who needs to be jailed, and that's where the racism lies.
I don't believe this is racism at all. I think this is
arrogance.
I think just a
second.
I think this just a second. I think this is arrogance.
Hang on, Julianne. Hold on.
This is arrogance on the part of the union, and yes, it's arrogance on the part of the MTA. If I were the governor, I would require the chairman of the MTA to resign. I would require that that in order to settle this strike, that there will be no negotiations until people are back to work. And if I were the judge, I say jail. And if I were the people who were in power, I would say no amnesty in terms of fines. People would run back to work. They are
all right, hardliner. Let me bring it back to something. let me bring it back to something that Julianne raised and Charles Ogletree. Pick it up for me. If we take this as a microcosm, one of the things that we're seeing in the United States across the board, quite frankly, is the change in what used to be very solid, a foundation, if you will, and that is the pension fund system across the boards. And as Julianne alluded to just a moment ago, this, not only with this strike, but all of the changes we're seeing across the country will disproportionately affect people of color in this country.
That's true. It's the lifeline. When you talk about quality of life and wondering what your life's going to be like when you can't work or unable to work in your declining years, you work now with the hope that there will be a cushion to help you live down the road. And so these things are not just about whether or not you get another dollar or another day of leave. It's whether you have a quality of life when you can no longer work. And pension is essential. If you look at private industry, it's very important. You look at every other industry, it's very important. And these workers deserve that basis. I want to just comment on Julianne's point. I didn't finish my point. The issue of race is complicated as well because, you know, we all know Bill Lucey, who is a very prominent African-American, been involved in labor for decades and nationally respected. I think it's the changing face of the union movement. That's a good thing, that it is becoming more and inclusive. It's becoming more representative of the workers of the nation. And I think that ultimately will, with more black mayors, with more black public officials, I hope that will help down the road as well to make sure that folks who are rising these positions will be able to make sure that those who work for them get a quality of life.
You should not mistake the facts. The pensions are not an issue in New York.
Present workers can retire at the age of
55.
But
the only issue
on the
is
right. All right, guys. Listen, we are not going to bang out. Listen, we're not going to bang out negotiation for the MTA on the show today. So let me move to something else that has hit the wires.
Tiny point, if I might.
Real quick, Julianne. Real quick.
The other issue is that the pensions are part of the deferred compensation. Unions have been very reasonable in the past because there have been pension contributions. So it's patently unfair to go back after the fact and say we want to take that away.
Right.
All right. And that continues to be the rub in all of this, and we're seeing that happen more and more across this country. All right, let me move to a headline. And again, Charles Ogletree, I'll go and defer to your legal expertise here. We are seeing that two of the police officers involved in the videotaped beating of the victim that so many of us saw infamously being brutalized by officers, 64-year-old Robert Davis, have been fired by the New Orleans police force. The union is vowing to fight the firing of these two officers, suggesting that the media frenzy surrounding all of this made it impossible for them to receive a fair hearing. We should note that a third officer has been suspended for 120 days and three others will face trial January 11th for various charges. That being said, when you hear something like media frenzy making it impossible to get a fair hearing, we hear that kind of defense all the time, Charles Ogletree. How realistic is that one and how do you see that in this instance?
Well, here, it's not media frenzy. The videotape tells the story, and it tells it in a very powerful way. Here was a nonviolent, innocent individual walking the streets and being brutally beaten. And I think the action taken is a modest measure, but an important step in the right direction. And I think it sends a message that what might have gone on in New Orleans or in South Central Los Angeles or in New York or any other place before just won't be tolerated. And what's great is that the objection to this beating were not along racial lines. Every person who saw it said this is just incomprehensible and certainly can't in any way justify it. So I think it's an important first step. I'm very interested in not what the New Orleans Police Department is doing, but I'm worried about the federal role because there were federal officers involved in this, and I think we should not see this first step as a conclusion to the problems of misconduct. It gets deeper and larger, and I hope that will be coming to the public eye, and the press will help bring it to the public eye as we go forward.
We should note also, Michael Myers, that a federal civil rights investigation has been launched through all of this. But I'm curious, Michael, your take on here is yet another, even if you include the extenuating circumstances of the time in New Orleans during Katrina, yet another videotaped beating of the brutalizing of an African-American male. This seems to not go away. This happens, quite frankly, daily in this country. When are we going to see the ire up of the community as it was in Rodney King to try to finally put stopgap measures across the board to assist in stopping this kind of action?
Well, you have such measures in place in some cities and locales, and you have departmental trials for officers who break the rules, and you have federal prosecutions for people who violate your civil rights, and in some states you have civilian complaint review boards, and in most places you have internal trials where departmental trials where the police commissioner or whoever is in charge of the police department has a right to discipline the officers and fire them for misconduct. So. But, you know, when you say let's go to the videotape, you can't then just say cry, it's media bias. I agree with the professor. Prejudicial climate is something that usually is raised in a court of law in terms of prejudicial impact on the rights of the defendant. This was an internal departmental situation. The police commissioner chief, in my judgment, had the videotape proof, and there was virtually little to no defense. And so they're out for good, and I say good.
Julianne, pick up on that point. Both Michael and Professor Ogletree have suggested that the sense of media frenzy does not pass muster here. Do you buy that, or is there any indication that can be used by the defense in suggesting that while it looks bad, the idea that it was played over and over and over and over again makes it impossible to find a way to defend these police officers?
I think it's impossible to find a way to defend behavior that's indefensible. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the media. The only thing I would say is to step back for a moment and look at what I would consider the trickle-down dehumanization of the black people of New Orleans that happened in the wake of Katrina. First, you heard these rumors of rapes and lootings that were not taking place. Then you had our government literally abandon people for 5 days. Then you had these police officers behaving. The Red Cross didn't go because they thought it was too dangerous. They did collect money, but they didn't go because they thought it was too dangerous. And then you had these police officers either A, walking off the job, or B, walking around in, you know, crazy stress because they thought everybody was a lunatic or a murderer. And so you had a trickle-down dehumanization, a climate of dehumanization in New Orleans at that time. This is no excuse, but I think we have to look not only at these officers and at the police chief. And my only question would be, why did it take so long? I mean, this happened, you know, in early September. Here we are at the end of the year, and these folks have been coasting. Why did it take so long? But why still do we have evacuees who don't have anywhere to live? Again, the term I would use is just the trickle-down dehumanization, the notion that black life is cheap.
Here's the interesting point. Pick up, Charles, but here's the interesting point in that. If you buy Julianne's assertion that there was this dehumanization, much of that, quite frankly, in the first few days when we heard about the story she talked about, were being told by black police officers and officials in the city of New Orleans as well.
Well, but I think the larger point is that we had media interest and focus on New Orleans when it was a gotcha story. What I worry about now is that we have media amnesia. People think that the issue has been resolved. There's suffering in New Orleans. Tens of thousands of people who can't come back home. The Ninth Ward is devastated. Jobs are not being given in proportionate numbers to African Americans who want and need to work. And I think the media is sort of, there's no picture of a crying baby. There's no picture of a single mom. There's no picture of someone on the rooftop. And so now there's little interest in New Orleans. And I think this is the most critical period of New Orleans, where we have to worry about both Donald Trump and Donald Duck finding a place in New Orleans for entertainment development and not thinking about how to rebuild this community for the national residents. So I hope our focus will be on media interest and not media amnesia about one of the greatest natural disasters in our country's history.
Lest we forget, Michael Myers, one of the things that we saw FEMA get smart about and the government in general is extending, at least through the holidays, the stay of many of these evacuees who continue to live in government-subsidized hotels but have no real prospect for housing when these terms are up, which will happen in January and February.
Well, since we're switching the topic from police brutality to the issues of social justice and generally
would you
speaking,
like to stay with police brutality, Michael
Well,
Myers? If that floats your boat, I'm in a giving mood during the holiday season.
Ed, you know he likes police brutality.
Excuse me, Julianne. I deplore police brutality, and as much as I deplore racial rhetoric, which really comes from the likes of racial awesomeness. Now, let me say this about about social justice. You know, like in the U.S. Senate and the Congress we've seen just very recently. You know, as Meg Greenfield said many years ago, we used to have a war against poverty in this nation. Now we've substituted a war against the poor. And the people who are the most vulnerable, the homeless, the vulnerable, the sick, the affirmed, the very poor, they need governmental subsistence and support. And they need jobs and education. And so this is the nature of social justice. But I can't wrap it all up in a package and say because there's police brutality and an incident of police brutality in New Orleans that that was brutalization or racial victimization. It was a brutal act. People paid for it. Good.
All right. Well,
my point is, guys, I got to stop it here.
We're at the clock. I'm sorry, Julianne. I'm always doing that to you, but I apologize. Julianne Melvo, Michael Myers, and Charles Ogletree, thank you so much for joining us. Very spirited discussion today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ed.